Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Brainstorm. We have two very special guests, Frank and Joseph. I'm here with Brett, as always. Sam will be back next week. And we are also very excited to announce we have a new partner in the show, Wolf Financial. I'm very excited to be working with them as they help us produce, edit, and distribute this show. So thank you to them. Thank you to Public. And thank you to everyone listening. We have a fun show lined up. Frank, Joseph, gonna send it over to you to talk about OpenAI, a potential $1 trillion IPO, but also the big news, which is the restructuring plan.
Yeah, I can kick things off with this. So last week, OpenAI announced the finalization of their restructuring plan, which has been ongoing now for a little while, generally pending negotiations with Microsoft. So now they've officially restructured as a public benefit corporation and provided some clarity as to the ownership ratios that come along with that. So they're governed by the nonprofit still, which is going to own 26% of OpenAI's for-profit arm, with warrants to potentially extend that ownership over time. And Microsoft is going to own 27%, so slightly reduced compared to where they were at previously. But along with that, Microsoft is going to retain its rights to IP and research at least through 2030 on the research side, and for IP and products through 2032 now. And in exchange for some more flexibility in how OpenAI is contracting its compute, they've also committed to a $250 billion increase in spend with Azure over the coming years as well.
What is the, so there's this weird clause that they had before in their relationship with Microsoft that seems to continue to exist in this restructuring, which is when they reach AGI, very poorly defined, something happens. What happens and why does it matter?
So when OpenAI produces what they're considering verifiable AGI, the revenue share agreement with Microsoft will end. Although some of the IP rights will continue under the new restructuring. The thing that I think is most interesting about that clause in their announcement, at least the way that they phrased it in their initial announcement of the restructuring, is that AGI has to be declared by OpenAI and then independently verified by an expert panel. So it seems that OpenAI has a lot of control over when that actually gets announced. And like you said, it's very nebulously defined. They were asked on a live stream what exactly is going to constitute AGI, and they kind of stepped away from this idea of it being a singularity and more of it being something that we phase into over a long period of time. And on the Microsoft earnings call, Satya Nadella said he doesn't see it happening in the anywhere in the near future, as they and OpenAI have defined. Seems like that's going to be.
Yeah, I think you use the term verifiable, and that's even a funny thing to say. Right. Verifiable AGI, which is this vague spectrum of increasing computer intelligence. It still seems very mushy to me. I heard
I feel like it de-risks. There was a risk to OpenAI where previously the nonprofit could declare that they had reached AGI. And then I think they were unable to commercialize further developments against that, or basically like took away their commercialization. So not only does it like, you know, say, hey, Microsoft, you're not getting share of profits, but also it seemed as if then the entity became purely paying out to the nonprofit rather than generating internal cash flow to continue to, you know, grow operations. And so taking this on to the OpenAI side, seems like it protects them to some degree, but maybe I'm misinterpreting.
No, I think so. I think also like just having a more traditional, still a public benefit corporation versus a standard corp, but a more traditional structure is just cleaner in so many ways versus the profit sharing agreements, where now this is a structure that can be taken public. And, you know, things like employee compensation through equity make a lot more sense. You know, now 47, I think I saw, percent of the company is owned by employees and investors. And that can be, you know, is a structure that can just be lifted and shifted into the public markets, which I think is something you alluded to, Nick.
Yeah. And well, before we get to the public market equation and part of the story, do we have any details on the expert council that decide AGI is verified?
Not really. No. It seems like it's being intentionally left pretty vague. And they've kind of backed away from providing a lot of solid details around that.
Okay. Yeah. So, all right. Well, vague definition of AGI defined by a vague board of experts. But nonetheless, we're heading towards a potential IPO next year, end of this year. The markets, as we'll get into later, Brett has a prediction market on when it will actually happen. But maybe help us understand why OpenAI is considering IPOing now.
Well, I think the number one reason is the sheer amount of compute that they're projecting that they need, and the necessity to raise capital as part of that. They are projecting increases in the amount of revenue that they're generating, but they're still going to need outside funding if they're going to hit that very ambitious 250 gigawatt goal that we've heard, or even just to fulfill on the $1.4 trillion of contracted compute that they've got currently. IPOing would open the door to that. There's some rumors circulating for second half of 2026, and Sarah Friar previously said 2027, allegedly said 2027 in internal documents.
And then Sam Altman on a podcast said there's no specific date. We're not thinking about that yet. So you have a variety of timelines that are leaked, but I think given the amount of capital that they'll need to raise to fund continuing scaling the business, it would be conceivable a year from now, which would be late 2026, it could happen, or early 27, which are the rumored articles. I think the estimate for all the compute announcements they've made over the last few months totals 26 gigawatts, which, yeah, I've seen. This is interesting because I'm really excited to do our own work and come up with our own estimate. The estimates of cost of total CapEx per gigawatt vary quite a bit from like 20, 25 billion to 50 billion per gigawatt. So I think Citi put out a number that was 1.3 trillion in CapEx, which is 26 times the 50 billion number. It could be half that if it's 25 billion per gigawatt of deployed compute. But nonetheless, they're going to need hundreds of billions of capital over the next 5 years to service all the demand that they're seeing, which I think is the important thing, is that they're not buying compute, hoping that demand comes. They're having many opportunities to use and deploy this compute that they are increasingly monetizing both directly and indirectly.
Well, presumably they're doing both, right? Because they are, yeah, they're needing to service inference demand. Like they add a user, that user uses ChatGPT with thinking mode on, or ChatGPT Pro or Sora, and that soaks up some of their compute. And then they also have compute that they're using to reinforcement learn their own models and try to develop whatever's next. And that second action, the paying for training compute, is basically betting that the money I put into making these things better will actually pay back down the road, which so far has proven true. And I think, and we think, is going to continue to prove true. I mean, the models are still, they're remarkably capable, and they're still very dumb. And there's a lot of evidence that they're going to continue to get smarter. And a smarter model in a world that is also very dumb is a very valuable thing. And so I think that's the trajectory they're on. What do you think about the $1 trillion number that's being floated? Currently, OpenAI is $500 billion, at least in the private markets. Does $1 trillion make sense, not make sense? How do you think about that relative to public comps?
Well, I guess the one thing I'll say to kick it off is it does imply, if you take it alongside some of the numbers Sam Altman has given on their ARR projections, it does imply a compression of multiple, at least in terms of their valuation as a multiple of ARR. So Sam Altman on a podcast just recently said that OpenAI could reach $100 billion run rate in 2027. So if they IPO at a $1 trillion valuation in 2027, in the same year they hit $100 billion in ARR, it's roughly 10x ARR. Compared to if they end this year at around 20-ish billion in ARR, they're currently at, say, 25x ARR. So
what are public comps like? If I were to go out into the software as a service market in the public equity space and be like, I want a hot AI name, not even a hot, a medium hot AI name. Like what is the comparable?
When you said hot, I was thinking Palantir, which Palantir over next 12 months sales is 94 times. Yeah. But if you're thinking like mid-range high growth SaaS, like Figma, for example, is trading at 20 times sales. Now the capital needs for the two businesses are very different, but still, you know, 10 times sales doesn't sound crazy.
Yes, it really depends. Yeah. It's not just a revenue thing. It's what revenue are they printing, and then what gross margin is attached to that? Because if people if you have revenue like that, but you're still, you know, there have been rumors about Cursor and kind of like the code Windsurf, you know, selling compute for less than it's worth, hoping to like carve out a strategic position. So kind of the, from what we understand from public reporting of OpenAI's gross margin, it's actually reasonably healthy. So they're selling compute. They're selling their service for less than they're paying for their service. That's a good business model. So if they come to market with a very high growth revenue, but then they're, you know, selling dollars for cents, then I don't think that would be well received. But if it is like, you know, more SaaS-like gross margins, then it seems like they'd have plenty of opportunity to float at that level.
I think we should go back to that podcast Joseph mentioned, which was the BG2 podcast, because it does explain potentially the squishiness in the numbers, as in the expected or the reported revenue today of OpenAI is somewhere near $13 billion. Sam, I think, squashed some of that and said we're doing a bit more. But then you have that $1.3 to $1.4 trillion in total committed spend by the company. And when he was asked, you know, how do you make sense of this? He said, you know, we're going to grow into this valuation because we're going to potentially do $100 billion in 2 or 3 years. But I think there is still a pretty big question on if that is feasible. Brett, you've done some numbers here. You think we're going to have everyone in the world using ChatGPT or one of these chatbots in very little time compared to other past innovation cycles. So I know where you land, but maybe explain some of it, because I find it a bit hard to believe, more on a time basis than, you know, it will happen. I think it will happen, but there is a big question of how fast. And people are seeing the speed at which people have adopted this technology and are saying, well, it's just going to continue at that pace. And I don't personally believe, I think we'll see a slowdown a bit from triple digit growth to something a little bit more moderate as we grow into our current understanding and of these chatbots.
Well, they imply a revenue growth slowdown in their ARR numbers that they're targeting, as in they're growing something like 3x year over year, but then they're implying they're going to double or a little more than double and then a little more than double again. So there is some kind of slowdown implied. I actually think, well, one, I think around 5 billion people are going to be using AI chatbots well before 2030, just given the kind of current diffusion curve. Now, it could plane off, like it could be like, well, we've had enough of this stuff. My suspicion is it won't. But on the margin, it's been people using Gemini on a weekly active basis rather than OpenAI. So there's no guarantee that OpenAI wins. They have, call it on a time basis, though, 90% of the market right now. And right now, I think ChatGPT-5 and some of the frontier models, in certain tasks, they are, you know, barely better than productivity delivering, as in they deliver you kind of an output and you have to error correct that output and figure out what's wrong with it. And that takes some time. And you, as a high-end knowledge worker, a lawyer, a doctor, an investment banker, you can actually get a boost from it, but it's like it requires learning how to use it. And but their improvement on their ability to deliver productivity is measurable and forecastable. And I think it's going to go from like a 20% productivity uplift this year to something like 60 to 70% next year to call it 150 to 100 to 200% the year after. So what that means, the way I interpret how they're going to be able to price, at least to the enterprise or kind of prosumer side, is that the value of the business to an end user, what I'd be willing to pay for it, I'm already probably getting a discount on 20%, but say that discount remains, it's going to triple over this year on a per user basis. So forget increasing the number of users, their pricing power is going to triple, and then it's roughly going to triple again. So the combination of the two should be like a 10x in pricing power roughly over 2 years. And the number of users of AI chatbots is going to go from like 1 billion to 5 billion over roughly the same time frame, a little longer. So I have a 5x in the number of users times a 10x in pricing power. So that implies that I could do 50x the revenue. Now, that's not what they're forecasting. That's not what they're like saying is going to happen. But I think that's the underlying pricing power in kind of the system as a whole, where it could go, you know. And so then when you're in a situation where you have a ton of pricing power, it gives you a ton of strategic leverage, and you can actually kind of like push your number. You can balance off growth versus what I'm doing on revenue versus like how much strategic space am I taking up? And it puts you in a really good strategic relationship with investors and the street, where you can deliver to them the top line growth that they need in order to continue to underwrite your float, while also holding a bunch of stuff in reserve to use to continue to deliver that growth. And that's, I think, where the industry is going to be, where they're delivering an amazing discount to end users, and end users are lapping it up, and kind of like they're pricing sufficient to basically allow them to capitalize the CapEx they need, but they're not being hyper aggressive on pricing because they don't yet need to. And so examples of businesses that were in that spot, I think Meta, back when it was Facebook, was in that kind of stance for a long time, where they had, you know, they can pull a lot of levers to continue to drive monetization. And at some point, like charging your users more, you know, it pisses them off over time. Or like within the Google search context, like polluting Google search with ads, it has degraded the experience over time. And but so Google held back on doing it until, hey, we need another like few points of growth this quarter, and began to do it. Netflix, the same thing. They were way under monetizing relative to linear for a long time. And that's given them so much. People always said, oh, how are they going to pay for all this content they need? That's impossible. They can't compete with these big guys. And they just had so much pricing optionality because they were delivering a great service to end users. And so I think that's roughly the stance the industry is going to be in. I don't know that Sam Altman has done the work to understand that, but I think he's more kind of reacting to the game that's on the field, knows that he needs to, like, you know, deploy a big chunk of capital, can see like the trajectory of the business is good. But I think that fundamentally that's where the industry is going to end up. And kind of that $1.3 trillion, who knows how much of it they'll fund with debt, how much they'll shove onto partners' balance sheets like Vision Fund. It's not that they are going to necessarily like have to capitalize that within the OpenAI wrapper directly. Presumably, they'll have to put some equity in play, and that's what they'll raise from the public markets for. But I think that the underlying, basically a dollar thrown into GPUs at this, or into your own custom chip, hey, even better, you're not paying NVIDIA's gross margin for this specific capability, I think will be great ROIC. And so then that's why kind of the street will ultimately love it. And, you know, when they float, I think there's going to be people saying, this is so crazy and overpriced. This isn't like any other business. It's so capital consumptive. This is a sign of a bubble. And, you know, frankly, I think that that is the incentive structure in media to say that. That's the way you get amplified. And it's also the way to not make a ton of money.
Do you think the hyperscalers, and maybe this will transition us into the next topic, which is CapEx from Google or from Alphabet, from Meta, from Amazon, from Microsoft, you know, this totality of their total CapEx is in that $1 trillion range or is heading towards it very fast. Do you think that they can be the spoiler to this pricing power story you talked about? As in, let me frame it in this way. Your Alphabet, you're seeing rapid growth of Gemini. I think they just hit 650 million monthly actives. You are incentivized to try to keep pricing as low as possible. One, because you can afford to do it because your core business is a free cash flow machine. But also, as you mentioned, they own the entire stack, right? Like they're one of the only players that own from the chip all the way up to the end chatbot interface. So if I'm Sam Altman and I'm trying to push this market in the direction of pricing power because I need that as, you know, for my business, because I don't have Google search and YouTube and all these other line items that are spitting off tremendous cash. Don't you think Gemini, Meta, and Amazon, anyone else playing in the space is just going to say, we're just going to keep our subscription $20 a month and float it into a bundle that is so aggressive on pricing? ChatGPT, OpenAI, they have no option but to try and compete somewhere else because they're not going to be able to raise from 20 to 40 to 60.
When Disney launched Disney Plus or whatever they call it at like, what was it, $6 a month, did that turn out to be strategically wise for them, do you think? They got a ton of subscribers that way.
Well, I think the story is yet to play out there, but I also think this is, I don't know if that's the right analogy. I think this is...
But that's the same thing. That's what people said about Netflix all along. It's like, listen, these guys have much better IP. They don't have to pay out the nose for IP. They have basically a better cost basis. Therefore, when they decide to dominate this market, they're going to come in with a low price and they're going to dominate the market. And, you know, that's what Disney did. And... now suddenly they're like, oh gosh, we need to be profitable. I think part of the story here is these, we need a ton of capital in data centers, and that capital is in excess of what is on these very flush balance sheets of mega cap tech. And so for a little while, they can play that game where it's like, we're going to give it away. We're going to fund the CapEx as an R&D rather than like assign it as an expense against this. So we don't like kill our gross margin, at least optically, even though effectively we are. Then therefore we're going to dominate the space. And that could well be what Alphabet's doing right now. I think with Nano Banana, it probably is their image generation model. And ultimately you do have to pay $1 trillion for something, right? And that's actually really big relative to the rest of their business. And so you quickly get into this game where actually you need to price rationally. Or I would say in this instance, you more quickly get into the game where you need to price rationally than you would in other kind of nichier applications where it's like, you think about Microsoft versus Slack, where Microsoft's like, hey, we're going to bundle Teams into the Office suite and you're basically not going to pay for it. And Slack was growing very quickly. Yeah. And it caused Slack to fall into the arms of CRM because they... basically got the top of their growth clipped off. I think that here there's...
I like that analogy
one, there's
than Disney versus Disney. But maybe Frank or Joseph, do you have thoughts here?
Yeah, yeah. What do you all think? What do you think Alphabet's move here and how vulnerable is OpenAI or any of the other startups relative to that set of...
Well, I think one thing is like, you went through kind of TAM sizing earlier. I think we can generally agree that like increasing knowledge worker productivity and creating a new consumer operating system is a very large opportunity. And do you think there will be one player that wins that or a few large players that share a portion of that TAM? And you have one company that starts it off and leads out the gate like OpenAI, but I don't think necessarily there's only going to be one company that's a winner. And I think there's probably room, just like in the cloud computing market, for multiple very large companies to have a role. Or you could even like, if you think of the internet as like the, you know, the previous very large paradigm shift, there are multiple winners of the internet that specialize in different things. There's like Amazon on e-commerce, there's Meta from social, there's Google from search. Like we could see some level of like multiple giants that specialize in different ways, even though there are overlapping products. It kind of feels like we're heading in that way. I'd be like very surprised given like how general purpose the technology is that you have just one company that takes all the value.
Yeah. It's like you don't have to... It doesn't have to look like the search market in order for it to be extraordinarily valuable shared off of a few players. But to me, there is more like network effect and consolidation impulses here than there is in infrastructure as a service. And we can see that infrastructure as a service stabilized, at least in Western markets, into basically three players. I guess now with the neoclouds, maybe it's a little messier, but you know, at the end of kind of like the cloud compute cycle, you had three players all managing to do like 30 to 35% operating margins. And that's roughly how we underwrite, call it the foundation model space. There's also just seeing our own IT department respond to this stuff where they're like, whoa, these things can do lots of things. This seems very scary and risky. So their pressure has been, well, you have to decide on which platform you're going to use. So we're using ChatGPT, at least principally rolled out across the org. Not because like, I think that, you know, Gemini is an interesting platform and I play with it and experiment with it and Claude is interesting and Grok is interesting. But for them just being able to be like, well, we're going to just count on this company to have kind of like, you know, that we're going to try to vet and experiment with, that serves as its own, you know, kind of, it's not, enterprises will like try to dual source, but then there's a lot of incentive here where you have a very kind of uncertain set of capabilities to kind of
rely upon a single provider, because then you feel like you have a single source of risk as opposed to multiple sources of risk in your org. My bias though would be yes, that kind of like in future state, you have 2, 3, maybe 4 of these entities in Western markets splitting a pie that's on the order of $10 to $20 trillion in value, with, you know, rather than a single search provider type instance that's taking all of it.
Let's end with maybe, you know, where the biggest question mark is right now in AI, which is Meta, because you had both Alphabet and Meta report on the same day, both talking about very large CapEx numbers, expenses increasing, and yet very different stock reactions. And I think it's important to understand, maybe with Meta, there is a big question on, you know, when they increase their CapEx number, how revenue will ultimately be, you know, found. Because with Google and Alphabet, you have a cloud business, so you can very much trace, you know, we're spending a dollar on infrastructure, you know what your ROIC will be. But with Meta, they don't have that business. They're looking to either increase advertising and engagement on their core, you know, offerings in the family of apps, or, as they alluded to, build out Meta AI. But I think there is a big question on how profitable, how much revenue can a chatbot bring in? And I think this is maybe why the stock sold off versus Google and Alphabet, which did much better. And I think this is where the real ground war is taking place in the public markets for investors trying to understand this story, because you have Meta, which has access to 40% of the global population that's on the internet, which 3.5 billion people. And I say to myself, and I think I've said it to everyone at ARK at this point, if Meta can't figure out how to monetize AI, nothing that's happening right now makes any sense, right? Because if they can't figure this out with the access and distribution base that they have, something is really wrong. They're also just the best at advertising. Like, there are real reasons to be concerned if Meta can't figure this out. But I want to open it up. I'll leave it there and just get puts and takes from everyone.
Well, I mean, the one thing that was in my head, this is more of a comment than a hot take, but was if Meta can't figure it out, but other companies are figuring it out, do they just sublease $600 billion of compute to those that have the demand? Like, $600 billion is not going to, it's large, but it seems like we're likely going to have use for that compute over the next 5 to 10 years. So I wonder what the real downside is if they can make that compute available to others. You know, Mark got asked this question in so many quarters, are you going to launch a cloud computing service? And he always said no. And then they launched really their first kind of developer cloud product a few quarters ago with the Llama API. And I wonder how much they choose to expand that as a way to soak up excess compute if they do have that.
Yeah, great point, because that's exactly how he framed it in this quarter, which was, in a worst case scenario, we can sell our compute. If we can't find reasons to deploy this compute internally, which in the way that he spoke on the quarter was, in every instance when they've gone out and talked about how much compute to deploy, how much infrastructure to build, they've gone with their most aggressive assumption over the past few years. And in every instance, they've always been compute starved. So they've always needed more, because they've figured out how to deploy it for Reels or for video monetization or for internal large language use. And so to your point, Frank, I would agree with you, but there's still that question of, one, can they break in if they had to go that route and become a cloud provider? Can they break into a very competitive space? But also, I think people are saying, let's not even get there. Let's see if they can figure out how to monetize Meta AI, which internally and within their core family of apps, it seems like they're doing. I thought one stat that they gave, which, again, I'm not fully understanding the reaction here, because they're talking about there's already $60 billion of ad spend flowing through an end-to-end automated system. And so you can only just, you know, play that out over time. More of this will be automated, more of it will be run.
I guess the question would be, it's like they already are this dominant ad player. If to continue to dominate in this ad market, you now have to throw a ton of money at compute, then the interpretation is, well, okay, so your margins, you remain dominant and you continue to grow, but the margins on that business get compressed because then, and I do think that there's like a big uncertainty bubble around monetization of AI chatbots for consumers and exactly what that will look like. As in, there's definitely like a prosumer class that'll pay directly. It's possible, and I would argue it's likely, that more people will pay directly for these services than at least the previous internet generation of services, where they all had to launch at free and advertising monetize, or at least post, you know, people paid for AOL and they still pay for their ISP. You know, you still pay for broadband, but kind of like the core, at least initial fast growth services were all indirectly monetized. And Google, you can interpret Google's winning in search is in part creating cost per click, like the ad format that exactly matches to it. And Nick, your work is that, hey, this is going to be monetized with AI purchasing agents, where it's kind of purchasing facilitation. Basically, the marketing budget becomes the advertising budget in some way, and it goes through that channel. I believe that. I think it's a pretty good framing for how this is going to happen. And if that's where kind of the marginal monetization of AI for consumers goes, it's unclear that Meta is very well set up for that future because they don't have like a strong digital wallet play. There's a bunch of other kind of teams going after that digital wallet kind of purchasing agent franchise. You know, most of their users, they have 3.5 billion users, but I would wager that those users don't have credit cards attached because they've always been on this indirect monetization. And so then it's like, well, to continue to do advertising, which is maybe not the right monetization mechanism for this because it's purchasing agent and direct pay, we have to throw a bunch of money into compute. But then meanwhile, there's like this kind of like the way in which consumer AI maybe gets monetized happens through these digital wallet guys who are already in a strategically more interesting position, WhatsApp aside, then kind of like they're a little wrong-footed. And then layer on top of that, they've just like, I don't know, hired a whole new set of staff at some obscene number per head and fired some other set of staff who are all pissed off because these new guys came in getting like $1 billion pay packages. And you have Alexander Wang, who basically like, you know, grit sweated his way to the top by mechanical turking a bunch of data labels in a commoditized way, like, and raising money from investors and somehow got acquired in for billions and billions of dollars. Like, I don't know how I feel about their team because we haven't seen the evidence of what this new team is doing. And meanwhile, Zuck's like, hey, we're going to push, you know, $70 billion to them. So I think that's kind of like the complete set of complexities here. It's possible that, yes, advertising, I 100% believe advertising is going to be like totally driven by generative AI. You're going to need to do it to compete in advertising. That kind of like they're going to figure out a way to usefully use this stuff. But it could mean good top line growth at worse margins. And then the kind of like marginal growth in actual AI consumer monetization is happening outside of their strategic footprint.
It's fair criticism. But you did bring up one point, which on purchasing agents, which I think we're starting to finally get some data points. You know, before this, it was all theoretical, like this is what the consumer is going to want. Amazon gave us the first, I would say, real concrete data point in their last earnings. They're on a projected $10 billion run rate in incremental spend thanks to their chatbot that lives on Amazon Marketplace called Rufus. So people are using it to purchase, to find additional ways to spend on the platform, to answer questions they probably would have had to spend too much time to try and figure out. So I thought that was a really great data point from our perspective because I agree. You know, it's really hard for me to make sense of where this revenue is going to come from because having looked at a lot of consumer platforms, it's really hard to ask people to spend directly for something. So you have to look at indirect monetization. So I think clipping off a take rate that's deeply embedded into the purchasing structure, makes a lot of sense. And then advertising obviously is a huge component of what I think will make a $1 trillion valuation potentially make sense in 2 years' time.
Joseph, Frank, have you ever actually asked Rufus?
I was just going to say, I am actually a happy user of Rufus. Wow. Not all the time. I've actually used it, and I actually bought something using it. And it's like, it's maybe the nerd in me or like the inner analyst, but like I have this problem where it's like, okay, I need paper towels and toilet paper. So I go to Amazon and I type in paper towels and I get 20 paper towels, and I cannot help myself but like looking at them and trying to figure out which is the best paper towel. And so I just asked Rufus, like, get me the best review paper towels, like bonus points if it's something that I've bought before. And it found it, and I just clicked buy. And I was like, okay, well, that took me less time than it normally does. And there was something else I can't remember. I was comparing two different things, and it was like summarizing the reviews for me, and I found that helpful too. So yeah, I've used it multiple times.
They did say on the earnings call as well, customers using Rufus are 60% more likely to actually complete a purchase.
There you go.
Boom. There it is. This is how you monetize this future. That's my firm belief. That's like the most certain I feel in anything we talk about when it comes to AI is people will use these as digital assistants to run and navigate all of the purchasing they make in the future, because you're just going to embed more and more trust. And that's where the real revenue opportunity lies. But let's end.
I don't know about the real revenue opportunity, but that's where a big chunk of revenue.
Yeah, from the consumer perspective. I speak from the consumer mindset. Obviously, enterprise is a whole different story that we don't have time for today, but I'm sure we'll get into it in a future episode. Brett, let's end on a prediction market. Take us back. We're talking OpenAI IPO.
Yes, the Ledger this week. Frank and Joseph, you're going to have to. We have one guest slot. The guests get to like throw in a bid, but you're going to have to come to consensus. Nick and I can go on. All right. The question is 38% chance that OpenAI IPOs by the end of 26. And in this definition, it means actually lists, not just files in S1. So 38% chance. Do you think yes or no? Frank, Joseph, you first.
I say no. I say 27.
I agree with that.
Okay. Nick?
I'm trusting Frank and Joseph on this one. I need to try a new strategy. If I just go with my gut reaction, it hasn't been faring well very, very lately. I'm going to trust the analysts that are deeply covering OpenAI. And I'm going to say 27 with them.
Yeah, I think 26 is... The reason they would do 26 is basically the markets are screaming. They're trying to hit the IPO window. They go ahead and file and list because it's like, why go through another private round before doing so? But I'm also no. I just think the timing is a little tight. They would need to be filing their S1, I mean, by kind of like the third quarter probably in order to list. And it's going to be just going through and selecting the bankers, and the size, scope, and scale of this IPO is going to be so absurd, presuming it goes through, as in so much capital will be raised, so much attention will be paid. I suspect that the bankers advising them will be like, this is going to be a big, big thing. We should target a spring launch. If we try to target it like, you know, around Thanksgiving, Christmas, that's like a terrible idea, because we'll have trouble kind of getting kind of like everybody to pay attention and underwrite. Everybody's going through performance reviews, blah, blah, blah. So I just think spring 27 is the more likely window, even if they are trying to slam their foot on the gas and get to market. So I'm going to go no.
All right. Full consensus. Everyone's on the same page.
Very disappointing.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, everyone, for the show. Next week, Sam will be back. Sure, we'll be talking more AI, because that seems to be, you know, everywhere these days. All right. Thank you.
ARK Investment Management LLC is an SEC-registered investment advisor. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public are separate, unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to any company marketing or selling the products or services of the others. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public make no representation or warranties regarding and expressly disclaim any responsibility or liability for any acts, omissions, losses, or damages of the other entities or their affiliates, officers, employees, or agents. No company shall be liable for any indirect, incidental, consequential, or special damages arising out of or in connection with this podcast or its contents. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK, and investors should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statement. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.